critics and curators, produces art's freedom from the market for mass culture. To state the obvious, Bill Viola's videos are not play-tested against target audiences in the Midwest, nor are producers forced on art bands like Awada to ensure that their sound will play inoffensively in shops or appeal to a core market of 11-year-old girls. So this cultural enclave is protected from vulgar commercial pressures, permitting free play with materials and symbols, along with the standardized breaking of convention and taboo. The freedom of art is more than an ideal. If, despite the small chance of success, the profession of artist is so popular, it is because it offers the prospect of a labor that is apparently free of narrow specialization, allowing artists, like heroes in the movies, to endow work and life with their own meanings. Equally, for the viewers of art, there is a corresponding freedom in appreciating the purposeless play of ideas and forms, not in slavishly attempting to divine artists' intentions, but in allowing the work to elicit thoughts and sensations that connect with their own experiences. The wealthy buy themselves participation in this free zone through ownership and patronage, and they are buying something genuinely valuable. The state ensures that a wider public has at least the opportunity to breathe for a while the scent of freedom that works of art emit. Yet there are reasons to wonder whether free trade and free art are as antithetical as they seem. Firstly, the economy of art closely reflects the economy of finance capital. In a recent analysis of the meaning of cultural dominance, Donald Sassoon explored patterns of import and export of novels, opera, and film in the 19th and 20th centuries. Culturally dominant states have abundant local production that meets the demands of their home markets, importing little and successfully exporting much. In the 19th century, France and Britain were the dominant literary powers. The U.S. is now by far the most dominant cultural state, exporting its products globally while importing very little. As Sassoon points out, this does not mean that everyone consumes American culture, just that most of the culture that circulates across national boundaries is American. Sassoon rules fine art out of his account on the sensible grounds that it has no mass market. It is hard to read trade figures for signs of cultural dominance in a system that is thoroughly cosmopolitan, so that you may have a German collector buying through a British dealer the work of a Chinese artist resident in the U.S. We can, however, get an idea of the volume of trade in each nation, and given the high proportion of international trade in the art market, this does give an indication of global hegemony. Here there are striking parallels with the distribution of financial power. It is hardly surprising that the U.S. is dominant, accounting for a little less than a half of all global art sales. Europe accounts for much of the rest, with the U.K. taking as its share around a half of that. Art prices and the volume of art sales tend to match the stock markets closely, and it is no accident that the world's major financial centers are also the principal centers for the sale of art. To raise this parallel is to see art not only as a zone of purposeless free play, but as a minor speculative market in which artworks are used for a variety of instrumental purposes, including investment, tax avoidance, and money laundering. Secondly, and to banish such crude economic considerations from the minds of its viewers, contemporary art must continually display the signs of its freedom and distinction by marking off its productions from those vulgarized by mass production and mass appeal. It can make a virtue of obscurity or even boredom to the point that these become conventions in themselves. Its lack of sentimentality is a negative image of the sweet fantasies and happy endings peddled in pop songs, cinema, and television. In its dark explorations of the human psyche, of which the worst is generally assumed, it appears to hold out no consolation. Yet, naturally, all of this ends up being somewhat consoling, for out of the negativity, quite another message emerges, that such a zone of freedom and free critique can be maintained by the instrumental system of capitalism. Thirdly, and most dangerously for the ideal of unpolluted cultural freedom, it is possible to see free trade and free art not as opposing terms, but rather as forming, respectively, a dominant system and its supplement. The supplement may appear to be an inessential extra, but